My name's Elijah, and welcome to the Roots Hospitality Podcast.
Yes, chef! Yes.
Welcome to the Chef's PSA and Roots Hospitality Podcast Takeover.
All right, rock and roll. How you doing?
I'm doing good. It's good to see you again.
Oh, it's good to see you too. I hope this hits off well. It's awesome to have you. And it's one thing I will reiterate. I know we talked about this before, but it is nice to connect with other chef podcasters out there. I know we tapped on this, but I think during COVID for me as well is that I know we started this for different reasons, but for me, having more content from chefs was just more enjoyable. You know, there was too many cooking shows made from just producers that just didn't know how to relate to us hauling ass in the kitchen every day. So to be able to listen in on a podcast or listen in or watch a movie that you know that they were just, you know, like, for example, like Chef's Table, you know, like focusing in on those details where you're like, oh man, that is what I miss. Just the scrubbing down at the end of the night, you know, or it's like the pride in your work, you know, all these things, like the way people shoot the movies, the way they tell the story, what is funny and what's not funny. Like all of those things are so integral to being a chef. So it's nice to connect with you and have you on to talk some more shit.
Yeah, no, I love talking shit. And I'll tell you, I think that most media companies like Food Network or Chef's Table, they always start out with really good intentions, like they're catering towards chefs. And, you know, a few episodes later, before you know, it's like, let's just cater towards everybody. And then they kind of lose the essence of what made it great. But, yeah, you know, they all start out with good intentions. And then, you know, I guess sponsorship gets in the way. Thank God we're not sponsored.
Thank God. Yeah. Well, I'm glad we can rock and roll on this, but I guess just to clarify to people as to why we've gotten together to talk shit is that I guess we just wanted to find a place where we can talk about what's going on in the restaurant industry, talk about what's happening around the world in media, film, books, restaurants, what's going on with chefs, just kind of highlight them and just talk about it because there's less that I'm finding that you can just listen to and go, oh, sick, I can catch up. You know, once every how often and stay tuned in what's going on and hear what these chefs have to say about it. So that's the point of this is, and if this goes well, we'd love to do more. So please, you know, shout us out if you like it. And we'd love to get back on and talk shit and talk about what's going on in the industry. So yeah, I guess to get rolling on the agenda, some of the things we'd love to talk about are restaurant wise, mass closing. That's been the kind of biggest one, I feel, for a lot of different reasons. Other things like in the media, we want the brief. Please tell me you've caught up and watched The Menu.
I have not.
Oh, Jesus. Oh, man. All right. Well, we'll briefly go over that for as much as we can. Obviously, Love Charlie as well. I think that's going to be really interesting to hear about the perspective on what they're going to draw on that. Kind of similar to Roadrunner, mind you. Like when I was watching the trailer and then I watched it, I didn't anticipate where that was going to go, that movie, the entire time. So we can briefly go over that and what we expect. Did the Michelin recently come out in the US?
Yeah, so California, the LA area, Southern California.
Does that get released in states? Is that how that gets released?
Yeah, so right now I want to say we have California, Chicago, New York, Miami, and I think that's all we have in the United States.
Yeah, so right.
There, you know, it doesn't represent the full country yet. There's no, you know, I'm in Texas right now. There's no Michelin stars given out in Texas. But in California, they just released their guide. Yeah, I'm excited to talk about that. It was nice to see a lot of the chefs that have been working hard get the recognition they deserve.
Yeah, sick. Awesome, right? Well, we can tap into that because I'd like to know what's going on over there as well, just from my end. And then some good books also I'd recommend. I don't know how many chefs are out there reading books these days, but are genuinely on your day off to just pick up a book, I don't care who you are, I would recommend it. So Will Gadara's latest book, he was the co-partner with Daniel Hamm at 11 Madison Park. So he's on tour with his book, so that was called Unreasonable Hospitality and the Art of Giving People More Than They Expect. So that'd be interesting to talk about that and where that's going. A Waiter in Paris, I just wanted to recommend that book. It was, I know it's more of a front of house book, but mm-hmm. I just wanted to talk about that because that's been really, really cool. It's well written from someone in the industry, front of house as well. And then, yeah, maybe finish on just some potential trends and where we see restaurants going. I feel like that would be interesting to maybe shoot our shot on where the fuck we see restaurants going in the next few months and just see how it goes. It'd just be fun. You never know. Something might stick and we'll laugh at it later.
Yeah, it'd be fun.
Yeah, well, what about for yourself? Is there anything you wanted to highlight?
Yeah, I'm on a campaign right now, and that is to get chefs moving over to Twitter. One of the things that I'm passionate about, part of the Chef's PSA thing, the podcasters, is being a chef, there's a lot of stories. There's a lot of ideation that goes on. There's a lot of discussion around food. And we're slow to move things forward because we're only looking at beautiful pictures and eating in restaurants, but we're not really having conversations with each other. And I think, you know, Instagram's a great platform. It's a great platform for chefs to put their food up, but Twitter's a great platform to move ideas forward and to connect and to have discussions. And I think that, by the way, of all the social media platforms that I'm on, I enjoy Twitter the most. Like I'm on Twitter and I'm having fun because everyone's arguing. There's so much shit talking. you're learning so much from very intelligent people out there, and it's like making, you know, delicious s'mores over a dumpster fire when you're on Twitter. And there's no chefs on there, and it's like, what, you know, chef Twitter is probably the worst, right? So anyway, I could go on.
All right, sick. Well, this is going to be good because I don't have Twitter myself. So I'd like to see what fires are burning over on that side of the social media platform.
Hopefully we'll get you a Twitter at the end of this.
Yeah. all right, cool. So I guess it'd be good to start by talking about what's going on in the restaurant industry around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, for myself, I've noted a mass. Did you want to highlight some interesting things going on your side?
Well, I can tell you from a trend standpoint, I think that I sit on a couple of different committees nationally, so I have a little bit of my finger on the pulse. Even though I'm not a chef anymore, I'm still heavily involved in the chef community, and, you know, going out to eat once a week with my chef Illuminati friends and talking shit. And you know, when we're out, you're starting to see a movement, and I'm curious about what's going on in the rest of the world, especially where you're at. Is that you're seeing these trends really focus down onto the individual. So I'll give you an example of what I mean. If someone's making Mexican food and they're from a certain town, and then they try and they're like, well, that's not authentic to that town. I've been to that town. That's not the way they make it. It's like, well, yes, but you didn't know my mom. That's how my mom made it. And this is the way I'm making it. And I'm doing this. And you know what? I'm making this up. This is not true, but I season my tomatoes with fish sauce. Okay, great. Well, I can do that because that's the way my mom did it. So if you don't like it, fuck you. This is my, this is the way I'm cooking. And I think that's going to be an interesting thing because we have all this groundwork in front of us of the history of regions and the way that they've been cooking. And it's all kind of been done outside of plating techniques. You know, the world is getting small really fast. So, you know, we could all plate the same, you know, maybe we'll reinvent something here or there, but the new flavors coming through have to come from the individual. And I think that's going to be the trend moving forward, is like chefs truly expressing their individuality, taking the skills that they know and then just saying, but this is who I am. I think that's what's going to move forward here in the States. However, I could be wrong. And if I'm wrong, I reserve the right to be wrong.
No, I can see that. If we're going to start on that, I can see that. And In Australia as well, like, I mean, I guess this is maybe more on the arse end of the effects of chefs now being highlighted when it comes to your cooking shows and shit. So now chefs can actually have a face to what they're doing, or the restaurants mm-hmm. have a face to what they're doing. And since that has started, this is kind of the onflow effect of that, that now you're starting to pay attention to the chefs. So now the chefs are telling you what they're cooking, not you telling them what you want. And you're going there for what they're doing, and you're not going there for what you feel like eating. So now that, because that script is now flipped, or that script has flipped, that you've got chefs, starting to be okay with sharing their story more, sharing their journey, sharing why their food means a lot to them. So I can see that for sure. I can totally see that for sure. I mean, I'm on that journey myself. It's just kind of, and I think this is good just to go onto that, because if they're genuine in that, and it's not just a marketing ploy, mind you, this is where I find chefs can be happiest the most as well, is when they're cooking food that is nostalgic to them and they're reinventing it in a way that makes them proud to do so. So taking their family's recipes, things they grew up from their parents, incorporating that with what they've learned along the way, and then finding a space and working with the suppliers around them to kind of culminate all that to give to a customer who is a fan of their work now, because they know their face. They know they come here for them. And I think that's cool.
There's going to be a big hurdle to overcome, and that's chefs are notorious haters, right? So they're notorious. The people that are filled with the most hater blood that I know are all chefs, by the way. And whenever they do something against the script, so I'm just making this up, but if you say, the way you make this is it starts with mirepoix, you roast your bones, you add your water, the water has to be cold, so let's just say, well, guess what? My mirepoix doesn't have celery. Well, how dare you, right? And that's not authentic, and you're making it wrong. So chefs
got the mirepoix.
Yeah. you can't just have carrots, you have to have celery. So chefs have to get over the fact that, hey, you know what? I'm going to do it the way I want. And other chefs have to be like, okay, well, he's taking... there's a lot of insults that go around, like, oh, that chef clearly doesn't even know mirepoix has celery in it. Like, yes, he does, or they do. Yes, they do know that it has celery in it. It's just let the fucking guy or the girl express. Let them do what they do. And I think that's going to be a hurdle, because it's going to be like the arrows coming at you of telling you you're wrong, and you say, no, I'm doing me. I clearly know how to do it the right way. I just want to do it this way. So there's going to be some hurdles there.
Yeah, and you know what? You tapped on something that I know we could just dive into hardcore, which is just like understanding your fundamentals. Because like I know we've run into a lot of chefs that have just skipped the whole TAFE and the culinary school and are just going right into cooking. And you have this debate where it's like, no. Like, although most of us will agree that, you know, TAFE is basically just like a waste of time and you learn more experience in the kitchen, but nonetheless, it's still a good fundamentals. So you can have this discussion over like, you just want to get there because you need to know the rules in order to break them, right? Like you need to know the history. It's interesting. It's interesting. But you judge. Oh, sorry. You go.
But would you rather have something that's delicious or would you have it made right? Like, I'd rather have something that's delicious than made right, in quotes, you know, made the right way or delicious. Yeah. I'd rather have the delicious version versus it made the right way. So like... the argument of it's not made correctly, it was like, yeah, but is it delicious? Yeah, okay, well, that should be the metric which all food is measured on. Is it delicious, exactly. Number one, right? Okay, great. Was it delicious? Great. Well, was it made right? Well, who fucking cares, right?
It's delicious. Yeah, exactly right.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, cool. I for sure see that. I'm curious to see where that trend is going to go, where how much more are we going to want to focus on the chefs in the restaurants, like, and where that's going to go, where that's going to stop, or where that's going to then initially change into now. Like, it's interesting now because, like, for example, in Australia, they've released this kind of campaign where they've got high profile chefs creating fine dining meals that you can buy in packages for home, for example. So these really well regarded chefs like Lennox Hastie, for example, or Peter Gilmore, they're creating these home packages for chefs to buy and eat at home. So it's like having Peter Gilmore cook for you at home. That's the point. So now it's like, okay, well, now we're bringing these chefs that we know home with us all of a sudden with their food. So it's developing so fast, and it's going to be crazy to see where that goes, man.
It'll be really interesting. Chefs are, this is the best time ever to be a chef, because you have, so when you work at a place, right? So let's say you're the chef and I'm your employee. And if you leave to another restaurant, so I have two options. I could stay and see what the new chef is like, or I could go with you, right? Well, the customer should also think about that as well. When you leave and you go to the other place, they also have a choice. Do I stay with the restaurant or was I loyal to the chef? The fact of the matter is, and you know this, you've been in the kitchen, you usually follow the chef. You know, you're not loyal to the building. You're loyal to the person that was taking care of you. Once customers figure that out, and that's why it's really important for chefs to develop their brand, their own identity, whether it's on social media, whatever it is, but they need to know that because restaurants like to restaurant owners, I'm calling them out, they like to pull that bait and switch, like, oh yeah, we changed chefs months ago, but the food's still great. And we won't mention that other person's name anymore. They're who knows where. But you know, the customers, if you're loyal to that chef, you should be able to follow them to the next place as well, because you know, hopefully they're creating the same delicious food that they were creating at the previous restaurant. Something that chefs need to be aware of is that they have, this is the biggest thing that I've been on lately, is chefs have way more power than they realize and they need to use it.
Yeah. Amen.
Yeah.
All right, let's get rolling. I want to talk about a mass. So in the real world, recently this happened like a couple of weeks ago. So a mass, for people who don't know, is this pretty well-regarded restaurant in Copenhagen. It's known for its sustainability and zero waste practices, led by Matt Orlando. He's an incredible chef. He's worked at Noma, for example. He's worked with Charlie Palmer. You know, just all these excellent chefs. So, but he opened up a mass with the idea of wanting to change not what we cook, but how we cook it, and then that whole process. So in terms of that, he was really fundamental in inspiring people and navigating the way to reduce waste. So little things like when the candles burn down low to where you can't use them, melting them and putting them in eggshell cartons with a wick and using them as fire starters for charcoal or whatever. Or having empty wine glasses and milling them down to a powder, incorporating that into your ceramics, and then glazing, like basically glazing that and firing it for new plates for the restaurant. So all these things, like really all these things that you don't even think about. It's not just food, it's everything. Mm-hmm. So they recently closed, which is, I felt was shocking. Like I was there recently to chat with Matt and you know, it was a really incredible vibe. The team there were excellent. Their communication, what their food, like what they were doing, their relationship with their small farm outside, it was just gorgeous. So it's a shame. And I think to talk about the potential impacts then, because the one thing you don't want people to start thinking is, well, why would I do a sustainable restaurant if the leading one's closed? Mm. You know, like it mustn't be profitable or whatever reason it is. Like that's the effect that you don't want, you know, like because this is going to be like a long road to get there, to get to a world in which chefs and restaurants are run in a sustainable manner where it's not just an afterthought. It's like, no, this is how we do it, you know? Like, so that's where I think, you know, for another conversation, but TAFEs can get into giving chefs that early mindset of how can we always save scraps. But yeah, so I just wanted to kind of highlight that because it's such a... It was such a fundamental place in terms of that side of chefing and running a restaurant, less about the food, but more just about actually running it and thinking about it, thinking about your staff, thinking about, you know, your waste and all that sort of stuff, which I think when you get to your sous chef or head chef or executive chef levels, you're often thinking about it because that factors into your waste, that factors into your food cost and waste cost. So I think, you know, less for chef de parties, they're less thinking about it. But when you get to that, when people are on your ass being like, hey, why the fuck you're a percent over, the, you know, this month or a couple of percent over, you know, and you're like, fuck, like, you know. So, yeah, I just, for myself, that was really, really crazy. And it's a shame. But I hope that Matt comes back fighting harder and coming up with a sick new venue to... Because I don't think he's stopped. Like, I don't think he's stopped. I think he's still got a lot of passion and energy for that ethos. I think just the space had come to an end, as it does. You feel like it's just for whatever reason. And then, yeah, and hopefully he's onto something new.
Now, anyway. I got to say that your podcast interview with him is honestly one of the best interviews of a chef that I've heard. And I think anyone that's listening to this right now should go listen to that podcast. It was exceptional. He's a brilliant chef. And it comes through in the stories that he tells and it's entertaining. It's really well done. And anyway, kudos to you and kudos to him. Sad to see him close his restaurant. I'm curious if he'll pivot to something more casual, because you, as you know, a lot of chefs end up starting here and then go to something else. It's a loss for the culinary world. He was an inspiration. And it's not like he's dead or anything like that. But I mean, we mourn the restaurant, not the chef. We celebrate the chef and everything that he accomplished. I'm excited to see what he does next, because like you, I think that most likely he will move on to something brilliant next.
Yeah. Have you heard about this? Have you heard about the Ninja Creamy that's come out?
I just saw it recently. I need to get one.
Is it like, I don't know if this has been released in the US or not. It's just only recently come out in Australia, only a couple of months ago.
I don't know, but hopefully if Ninja Creamy is listening, send us one. We'll review it. We'll talk about it. I need one for my house, and I have a Ninja coffee maker, so don't make me buy an espresso. it looks cool, though.
It's cool as fuck. Yeah. It's cool as fuck. Yeah, totally, man. Like, I've got one myself. I've got one there, and I fucked around with it.
Yeah.
It's sick. Like, we're talking, it's a pack on a budget here. Like,
yeah.
You know, and I've seen reviews, and I've used it myself. I've seen chefs in the industry just, like, kind of send off their videos and be like, hey, guys, just giving you a heads up. This, I can quenelle like this using this. Because, you know, quenelle's the standard here we're talking about, you know? Mm-hmm. This is, when we're talking about the texture and the creaminess of a sorbet that's been churned properly, a quenelle is the technique to prove, you know, that churn has been done well. So it's no fucking around. But yeah, honestly, for being a pack on a budget, I think it was like $300 in Australia. I'm not sure what that translates to in the US.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I fucked around with it. I did. I've basically done two sorbets, and I'm talking like I'm not just talking their recipe. I didn't follow their recipe. Mm-hmm. It's pretty shit. So. They've just got recipes where it's like put fruit and concentrate and then freeze that and churn it. I'm like, get fucked. Like, the chefs don't use that. You know, chefs don't use that shit. So I followed like a typical restaurant where it's got your fruit, your syrup, and then your stabilizers, right? So that's what we're using in the restaurant here for a sorbet anyway. So the stabilizers were like guar gum or xanthan or all that kind of shit. So like, I'm doing it as if I'm in a restaurant for a restaurant standard, and mm-hmm. it's going to be frozen and churned for that. And yeah, it's great. Like all I did was I churned it once on the sorbet, and then I re-churned it because for the better consistency, you always need a re-churn. And then you got your quenelle in no time. You're only getting like, if you're doing those petite quenelles, like the not overly huge ones, you get an ice cream parlor. But those petite ones, you're probably getting like 8 to 10 serves, I reckon. So just for the chefs listening to understand. And you get 3 Paco containers in the mix. Mm. So if you're doing 100 people a night, you're gonna have to buy more of the containers. But if you're doing like 20 or 30, you'll probably have enough. So but it's great.
And I'm sure you could buy just some extra containers, right?
Yeah, easy. It's easy, yeah. Easy. But totally. If Ninja Creamy want to send us some, we'll do some fucking... We'll chat at length about it, because I'd love to see the scope of what we can do here, you know? So
I agree. Ninja Creamy, if you're listening, don't make me say bad things about your product later.
And this is where... And I'll tell you what, with the Ninja Creamy now, this is where all the new chefs are like, who skip culinary school, like, fuck the anglaise. I'll do whatever I want, you know?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I don't fucking need that shit. You just chuck it in, freeze it, ready to go. So you're laughing. So yeah, for chefs that are doing pop-ups and functions and events, so far so good. I haven't had any dramas, any problems. But I think one other chef, Jason Saxby, was saying to me, he's a head chef at Ray's in the North New South Wales, mm-hmm. was saying that if it's going to be for high volume, it's treat it like a blender. You know, like mm-hmm. if it's your standard at home blender and you take that into a kitchen, it's going to be fucked by the end of the week. So. Yeah. Basically, but so far so good. I would recommend people giving it a go. It is so far worth the money. But
nice.
I'd love to hear people's reviews and problems they encounter. I've only had it for like a couple of weeks now, so
Ninja Creamy, get on it. Let's see what let's see what you can do.
All right. So if we're talking real world, I want to tap into the Michelin.
Yeah.
Still, I want you to lead this one because we obviously don't have Michelin over here, so I'm curious to see what's going on.
Well, God, and I don't have the guide memorized of who got stars and who didn't. But you know, I think the usual chefs that get the Michelin stars got the Michelin stars. You know, you know your Northern California French Laundry. You know, of course, Thomas Keller's, you know, amazing. A shout out to Chef David Breeden, the chef there. The Bennu's, the Manresa, those guys all got it. The interesting thing is the new three Michelin, which is Addison in Southern California. So they're basically in San Diego. They're inside the Fairmont Grand Del Mar Hotel, which Chef William Bradley's really been pushing hard for those three stars. And I want to say he started out with two stars and then, you know, maybe should have got three and then now finally got his three. So I want to say in the southern half of California, he's the only three-star place now. And, you know, I know William. We both sit on an organization together. And his hotel, the Fairmont Grand Del Mar, where Addison is, was also owned where I used to work. And so I had Garrison Restaurant. He had Addison. They're not the same, but same owners. For a period of time. So there's 6 degrees of separation there. And it's nice to see him get his three stars. He's a phenomenal chef. What they're doing is very high level, very interesting. And it's nice to see hard work pay off. And I think a lot of people aren't big on Michelin because, you know, for whatever reason, everyone has their own reasons. But I respect that. And I know when I was a chef in Texas. So I was a chef in California, in Southern California, before the Michelin Guide existed. So I was not eligible, even if I would have got one, I wasn't eligible. And when I moved to Texas, the restaurants that I was the chef at, we were pushing as high as we could, but there's no Michelin Guide either. So, you know, we'd get reviews from the newspaper. Or Forbes Travel Guide, which back then was the mobile travel guide. So those were what we would get reviewed on. And I can tell you as someone, as a chef that came from nothing, because I know the arguments are, well, you know, you must have had all this money financing you. Like, no, I am as poor as they come growing up. I came from the roughest neighborhoods and I had no advantages and no opportunities, and I'm a minority. So Let's put all that off to the side. And I know how hard I worked and I didn't get Michelin stars. So how can I not appreciate what they accomplished? Like, you have to sit back and admire what they've done. And, you know, there's arguments, well, they have 100 staff, and it's an incredible expression of what you can do with food, right? There, a lot of the newest trends come from, they really come from two ends of the spectrum. They either come from street food or they come from high-end food, right? They usually don't come from the casual middle. They usually come from the low end or they come from the high end. The casual middle, you know, isn't really putting out the next great food trend. But, you know, on the high end, you know, just because we're talking about Michelin stars, you think about chefs like Rene Redzepi, chefs like Thomas Keller, chefs like Ferran Adria, Paul Bocuse. These chefs moved the industry forward. Light years. And without chefs that were pushing for excellence and maybe driving themselves mad in the process, right? You know, the story of Bernard Loiseau from France, who ended up taking his life. And so you see the amount of pressure that these chefs put on themselves. It might not be for everybody, and that's okay. But it is for some people. And there's people that truly enjoy that. I was at a dinner the other day, and again, this is not Michelin, but I was at a dinner the other day, and most of the chefs that were at dinner with me have come from those types of pedigreed kitchens. And none of them have bad memories of those kitchens. All of them loved it. And so, yes, maybe it's not for everyone, but it's like it's special forces. It's the special forces of the culinary world. It's not for everybody because it does require a lot. And I'll say this. Hopefully none of this is getting me in trouble. But I will say this, like, there's people that say, I don't want to do this and I don't want to do that. There's a lot of effort that goes into getting a Michelin star. And that's 100% true. There's a ton of effort that goes into getting a Michelin star. But I'll say this, if you're a kid, right, and you're into a video game, How many kids are stuck at their video game for 18 hours a day and then you have to peel them off to eat something, go to sleep? You know why they're stuck? Because they fucking love it. They love it. They don't want to do anything else other than play this video game, right? Now, you know why those chefs are in those kitchens for 18 hours a day? Because they fucking love it. Like, they love it. You can't get them out of those kitchens. But it's the truth. So while some people choose to not work as much, or, you know, maybe I want an 8-hour shift, or maybe I don't want to work more than 10, that's okay. But there's some people that's like, you got to kick them out of the kitchen because they love it. They're driven. Like, it's their video game that they're playing. And, you know, the high score is 3 stars. So don't knock them because they love it, I guess is what I'm trying to say. They love it.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent way to put it. Because that's the one thing, you know, moving up in your chef career is that it's so hard. You can never explain why you love it to people who aren't in it.
Yeah.
Like, it's like you said, I think the video game's great because it's like, oh, you have to play it. Like, you have to watch this movie. You'll understand. And they're like, what are you talking about, you fucking psycho?
Yeah.
You know, why would you want to do that shit for 18 hours, you know? But I think that's actually a great way to put it. But yeah, it is interesting. It is really, really, really interesting. So, because I wanted, for me personally, I guess I wanted to know more about the Michelin, because we don't have it over here, and I don't know if Australia ever will. If most parts of the US don't even have it, I doubt we'll come to Australia anytime soon. But yeah, that's awesome. So I guess Addison was the restaurant to know.
Yeah, so they're the new 3 Michelin in Southern California, and I want to say that they're the only 3 Michelin in Southern California. Northern California has, you know, plenty.
Yeah,
I don't know how many they have, but they have enough 3 Michelin stars over there. But yeah, Addison was truly the restaurant was the shining star this year in the south of California. Now, you know, just one more point I'd like to touch on with Michelin is that the world is better when we have chefs on all ends of the spectrum. You know, chefs that are cooking here, chefs that are cooking here, and chefs that are cooking everything in between. And they all bring value and they're all feeding different people. And it's a beautiful thing. And I'm not someone that should, I'm not a believer in tearing down one aspect of the culinary world, because I know when I was a chef, and I've worked in everything, right? I've worked in a low end and I've worked in a high end. And I missed Christmas when I worked in the low end, and I missed Christmas when I worked in the high end, right? And I worked 7 days a week on the high end, and I worked 7 days a week on the low end. And the struggles that we all face in the kitchen, there's a lot more that we have in common that makes us different. Maybe the food that we're cooking is different, but we're facing a lot of the same struggles together. So to try and put a division with the style of food, to me, is ridiculous. Let people cook what they want to cook. It's all a beautiful expression of who they are. And put that nonsense aside, in my opinion.
That's great. I think that'll round up that. All right, I wanted to talk about a few books. Do you find yourself reading chef books? Not cook books, but just like books written by industry people?
Yeah, I do. But not that much. I got to be honest with you. All joking aside, I read about a book a week. And
yeah, right.
Yeah, so I did the math the other day. I think I read 162 books in the last, since 2020. Something
Holy
like
shit.
That. Yeah, I read a lot. But I don't read a lot of cookbooks. I don't read a lot of chef books. That's probably a small percent of what I do read. Because I'm trying to distract my brain from everything that is this industry at times. But I need to read this book. It's ironic that you brought it up, because a friend of mine, Gabe Morales, he was the Top Chef season 18 winner. He texted me today and he said, have you read Danny Meyer's new book? And I said, no, I haven't. Is it good? And he says, I think it's better than Setting the Table. You need to read it. So I haven't read it. I need to read it. I don't know if you've read it.
Sorry, did you say Danny Meyers?
Yeah.
The wrong guy?
Who just... Shit. You're right. I am thinking of the wrong guy. Will Guidara wrote this book, right?
Yeah, Will Guidara. Yeah.
Sorry, I thought...
Who's Danny Meyers? You've got another book in mind. I'm curious.
I'm thinking of Setting the Table.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, sorry.
Is this...
which is a great book. I'm getting my books confused.
No, this is good. I want to know more books. I'm going through my list of books and I find them interesting. What's this setting the table about?
It's basically his lessons in service, in hospitality, everything. It just covers just his philosophy, his ideas when it comes to the restaurant industry and how it applies to many other industries as well. It's a really great book. I read it years ago. It's a book that I would recommend to people. And yes, I know they both crossed paths with 11 Madison Park, and I think I got them confused. So apologies to them if you're listening.
No, this is good. The more books to recommend, the better. If you've read that, we could probably touch on more of that, because the Will Guidara book, I haven't read, but I'm seeing so much about it. I'm curious to see if people have read it, if they're listening. If you have read it, please drop a comment and just tell us your review, because I'd be curious to see what he talks about. Because since leaving, 11 Madison Park and that kind of relationship, it'd be interesting to see what he talks about. And because I know he's been really inspirational in terms of front of house leading restaurants and how they want to structure and if they're striving for a similar goal, like the importance of briefings and shit, all that sort of stuff. Like, he's been quite, influential in inspiring people to achieve whatever standard they want to. So in terms of what this book is then about, I'm curious, because is it going to be similar to what he's previously talked about, or is it kind of different? Is he leaving that relationship and kind of talking about the realities of hospitality, like all these things? I'm not too sure. So if anyone's listening, please just shout us out a review, leave a comment, talk about it.
Yeah, I definitely do get it. You know what book I will talk about that I would recommend for chefs to read is Escoffier and Ritz. So it's the story of Auguste Escoffier and Caesar Ritz, and how going through the history of the Savoy and the Ritz Hotel, and Escoffier's come up as a chef, and how he was basically the first celebrity chef. And there's some brilliant things in that book that still apply to today's culinary world. Take the food aside, like some of his tactics back then as a chef for marketing were like, they'd still work today. So I would highly recommend for chefs to read that book to know your history a little bit, and also, gain a fresh perspective.
Yeah, yeah. Is that the Savoy in London?
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Fuck. I went there recently, but I only went to the America Bar. I didn't go to eat. I didn't have that kind of money. Mm-hmm. But yeah, right. That's a beautiful place too. I was gobsmacked. I thought mm-hmm. I was lost. Because isn't... What other restaurants are in there? There's like a few restaurants. Is there like a restaurant?
I think Gordon Ramsay has a restaurant in there.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. I didn't want to sound like an idiot getting that wrong, but I'm fairly certain. I remember circling this place trying to find the bar when mm-hmm. I was there, because one of my friends, Martin Hudak, used to work at the America Bar. Mm-hmm. And he was just like, oh, you got to go check it out. And I was like, sure. And I didn't realize how huge this building was, for starters. But I thought, as you do, you have to go around the back way. Mm-hmm. And then I came across these like chefs just like sitting down on the pavement, just kind of having their break, right? As you do. And I was like, I miss home. Why am I traveling? And I just got chatting to them, and I was like, hey, like, how you guys going? Just on a break, da 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 da. And they're like, no, the entrance is on the other side. It doesn't look as dingy as this shit, because they're in the back alley, right? No one's walking around here, so that's why they have a break there. And chef life. But we went to the front, and it was just this magnificent place. It's crazy. Like, mm-hmm. just, I don't know. I've never been to a hotel so glitz. And, I mean, there's history to that place, first correct, and foremost. Correct. Like, mm-hmm. there is fucking history. So, of course, it's going to represent all of the clientele that it's hosting. And you got that when you look at it. It's just wild. So, I think it'd be very interesting to hear that and read that book, so, especially since going there as well. You can kind of put a picture to that.
You should check it out. The Escoffier's Kitchen, right? At the Savoy. And from what I understand, it's still pristine, just an amazing kitchen setup. So yeah, I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall in those days.
Yeah. Oh, fucking hell. I guess to finish up, well, I know we started on the trends, but another trend I wanted to, I guess, talk about is something that I've noticed as well in the ever-changing dynamics of restaurant and how they're having to develop and change since pre-pandemic. And I wanted to kind of talk about this to see where you thought it was going to go as well, is that the restaurant culture and brigade system and how that has changed since... I'm obviously talking about from what I'm seeing in Australia. So this will be mm-hmm. different in the US. Mm-hmm. But since pre-pandemic, I've noticed that kitchen culture, for example, has changed so much, right? And it has to, right? When you're facing the demands of, you know, staffing and all that sort of stuff and everyone being happy, was interesting to note that the style of leadership, I guess, has to change to cater to more people.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm saying? So like this has had to change a lot since, this has had to change a lot since the beginning and since now. So I think it'd be interesting to see where that's going to go. We don't have to talk about it too much in detail, but that's something that I've noticed is how the leadership has had to change to kind of make everybody happy instead of everybody having to adapt to the standards of the leadership.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of this inverse triangle going on. So I've just noticed that. I thought I'd throw that out there, and that's something that I'm curious to see how that's going to change over the next time.
Well, I think it goes without saying that some things that were happening in the kitchen are just plain wrong, right? I mean, I think that goes without saying. Some things were just not good. However, I don't think we should dismiss the wisdom with the wise, right? It's an expression that I like. Is like, just because you don't like that person doesn't mean everything that they did was wrong. And I think that there's a lot of things that we did wrong, and myself included. Like, I came up in that era, so I had my phase of tyrannical chef, and it took me a minute to correct it. I started out as a super nice chef, and then I became an angry chef, and then I ended my career as a nice chef. So I was like Darth Vader. I had my character arc, but I do think that there's a movement right now to remove hierarchy from kitchens, and here in the States. And I shouldn't say there's a movement, but there's a couple of chefs. I don't know any of these chefs, but it is a topic of conversation, and I want to understand it because I don't know how a kitchen can function without someone having responsibility over it, right? Someone having authority and responsibility for things when they go good or bad, because inevitably people act like people and they point fingers and they want to, when something goes good, we all want the credit, but when something goes bad, it was their fault. So I'm curious how this is going to work. And I'd like to speak to someone about it because I'm ignorant on the subject and I want to understand it. I want them to be able to steel man the case so I can understand it. I do think it's interesting. I do think times are changing, and I do think that the way that we manage is changing. But there's the elephant in the room, and I'll say this, and this is why I don't talk about it a lot. It's because to me it's like a puzzle that I haven't solved, and I don't like to talk about that I don't fully understand or that I don't get. And I'll talk about them. I just won't talk about them in public. And Here's the issue that I have, is that a restaurant needs to make money, right? And it has, most restaurants have very small bottom lines. I mean, Amas is closing, right? So they have a very small bottom line. And a lot of times it takes them years before they ever make their money back based on the note of the land or the building or whatever, right? So you have a stressed out owner, you have a limited amount of cooks, you have a menu that's this big, right? You have a food cost that you got to worry about, a labor cost you got to worry about, and all these things that are factored in, and the ticket machine is coming in, and we're dealing with young people in the industry, right? Servers and cooks and things like that, that are not used to this chaotic environment. And so it's like, if I'm giving you all the ingredients for a cake, I'm giving you flour and eggs and sugar, and I say, give me a beef Wellington. It's like, well, you gave me ingredients for a cake. I'm going to keep giving you a cake. And it's like, well, no, but we need a beef Wellington. I keep giving you this, but give me a beef Wellington. So it's like you put these people in a pressure cooker situation, and then we get mad at them when they behave like they behave.
Yeah, yeah.
And so Now, granted, some people take it to the extreme and they go overboard. But I do want to speak to that because I don't know the answer.
Yeah.
And I know it's a hot topic. And I will say this, and again, I'm trying not to get myself in trouble. A lot of people think they have the answer. You know, you talk to people and they say, well, just do this. And I want to say, point to a successful place that's doing it. Because I want to see that. I'm not dismissing it. I'm not saying it's not possible. I just want to see it so I can understand it. Because it's a puzzle that I can't figure out. So anyway, that's my rant. And I'm not, I'm all for a better work environment. I'm all for quality of life. I'm all for mental health. So I don't want anyone to misconstrue what I'm saying. I just don't know. I just don't know how you solve this puzzle. So it's hard for me to give advice on it.
Yeah, I think that's a great way. Because I totally agree with you. I think it's just kind of navigating that balance now coming out of all of it. So yeah, mm-hmm. If there are people that have that perfectly sorted out, please share it for everybody. Because I think that would be excellent. Mm-hmm. But other than that, I think that's a great way to close. I think that was a great, great catch up. And yeah, I really appreciate you jumping on and having a bit of a banter.
No, it was great. It's always good to see you. I can't wait to do it again.
All right, Matt. All right, have a good one.
Thank you. You too.
The Roots Hospitality Podcast is proudly supported by Sydney Direct Fresh Produce, the fruit and veg providor that are led by Luke Kohler, who has provided Sydney with some of the best produce for more than two decades and still smashing it out today.
Thanks for tuning into today's episode. If you'd like to listen to more episodes or check out some cool behind-the-scenes photography, then head to the new website over at rootshospitality.com.au or follow Roots Hospitality on Instagram for the latest updates. Cheers!